content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the September 7th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week in the foreground shows Donald Trump. He's got quite a scowl on his face, and he's standing chest deep in a swamp water. His tie is actually floating. There are cypress trees all around him. In the background, you can see the White House in the swamp, and it's kind of tilted to the side, looking like maybe it's going to sink. So the title is one word, Swamped: The Rising Legal Threats to Trump's Presidency. And we'll get to that article with the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Saying farewell to Senator John McCain. What happened? Tributes to Senator John McCain poured in from around the world this week after the former Republican presidential candidate died from brain cancer at age 81 at his ranch near Sedona, Arizona. Lawmakers from both parties came together to hail McCain, a six-term senator who famously endured 5.5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. President Trump triggered a White House public relations crisis by initially refusing to honor the senator, one of his fiercest Republican critics, and by insisting on flying the White House flag at full staff while the rest of the federal governments were lowered. Finally, relenting to pressure from top aides, Trump ordered the flag to half staff. Despite our differences on policy and politics, Trump said, "I respect Senator John McCain's service to our country." McCain will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda this week, making him one of only 13 senators to receive the honor. Former Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush will deliver the eulogies at the memorial in the National Cathedral, which Trump has not been invited to attend. Arizona's Republican Governor Doug Ducey said that he plans to name someone to fill McCain's vacant Senate seat only after he is buried at the U.S. Naval Academy. In a final statement obliquely aimed at President Trump, McCain called on Americans to rise above nativism, tribal rivalries, and hatred. "Do not despair of our present difficulties," McCain said. "We believe always in the promise and greatness of America because nothing is inevitable here." What the editorial said: "John McCain was an embodiment of many of the ideals that make America great," said USA Today. "In Vietnam, he chose to face imprisonment and torture rather than use his privilege as an admiral's son to be released before his fellow prisoners. In the Senate, he was a pragmatist who could form alliances across party lines and forgive old enemies to address difficult problems. His death serves as an almost perfect metaphor for the death of the old Republican Party, once led by principled statesmen such as Theodore Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and Ronald Reagan. Liberals loved McCain only when the maverick was infuriating conservatives," said the National Review. "But in 2008, they abandoned him for an even more alluring darling, Barack Obama. A tireless advocate of human rights and U.S. military strength, McCain unfortunately succumbed to a progressive republicanism that often made him undermine his own party. It's telling that his last vote was to preserve Obamacare, a policy he opposed to spite Trump out of sheer cussedness and pique," what the columnist said. "I've always identified as a John McCain Republican," said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. "Sadly, that party is no more. The time-honored virtues that McCain embodied, courage, loyalty, patriotism, honor, have been replaced with fealty to Trump and his xenophobic brand of American nationalism. Trump's inability to honor McCain, a bona fide American war hero, only proves how far the party has fallen." "Sorry, but McCain paved the way for Trump," said Laura McGann in Vox.com. In the worst decision of his career, he elevated the woefully unqualified Sarah Palin to the national stage as his vice presidential nominee as a sop to his party's right-wing base. She then proceeded to run a populist campaign based on white cultural resentment, unleashing a political style and a value system that animated the Tea Party movement and laid the groundwork for a Trump presidency. Despite the maverick myth he carefully cultivated, McCain could be as self-serving as any politician, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. But compared with Trump and Republicans who bow down to him, he comes off like the blessed love child of Abraham Lincoln and Joan of Arc. Whatever his faults, McCain was a giant, said Albert Hunt in Bloomberg.com. Besides his friend, Democrat Edward Kennedy, he was one of the two most important American politicians over the past 70 years who never made it to the Oval Office. He was a principled opponent of torture, a highly influential voice in foreign policy, and a relentless opponent of authoritarian regimes like Vladimir Putin's Russia. He was the senator no one could ignore. And we'll read a second shorter main story. Trump touts a Mexico deal to replace NAFTA. What happened? President Trump this week announced a tentative United States-Mexico trade agreement that he hopes will supplant the 24-year-old NAFTA. The North American Free Trade Agreement, which Trump has often called the worst trade deal ever, has been prime Trump target since the 2016 campaign. Canada was excluded from an intense round of negotiations, and major political and procedural hurdles stand in the way of the deal's ratification by Congress. The prospective agreement would require cars to be 75% comprised of parts manufactured in North America, up from the NAFTA-mandated 62.5%. Additionally, 40 to 45% of each car's parts would have to be made by workers earning at least $16 an hour, a salary markedly higher than the average Mexican auto worker's $5.21 an hour. Auto industry groups expressed concern that any deal without Canada would drastically disrupt existing supply chains and make U.S. manufacturers less competitive. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland cut short a European trip to come to Washington Tuesday to join negotiations on which the Trump administration has imposed a Friday deadline, rushing to finish before Mexico's new Senate is seated on September 1st. Freeland maintains that any overhaul of NAFTA requires Canadian approval, but she will be looking for areas where we can find a compromise that everyone can live with. What the columnist said, impossible is how one Republican congressman described Trump's plan, said Haley Byrd in WeeklyStandard.com. The White House is required to notify Congress 90 days in advance of signing any new trade agreements. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto leaves office November 30th to be succeeded by left-wing President-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador. That leaves U.S. and Canadian negotiators just days to come to terms. The administration insists it will push ahead regardless of Canada's involvement, though it's unclear why the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative thinks this is an option. At its best, this deal includes helpful modernization, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Agricultural producers, for instance, will be protected from regulatory abuse. But Trump's domestic policy is all about deregulation. So what's the economic logic of the added red tape and costs on the auto industry to punish imports? Even if this deal proves better for the U.S. than NAFTA, said Tyler Cohen in Bloomberg.com, it doesn't seem worth the price. Canada is an ally on issues pertaining to water rights, border enforcement, counterterrorism, and intelligence gathering. Trump's take-it-or-leave-it strong-arming will make Canada less inclined to support other U.S. initiatives. The president campaigned on fixing our stupid trade deal, said Catherine Rampell in WashingtonPost.com. But this deal would almost certainly require an enormous expansion of the administrative state to enforce the new burdensome requirements on manufacturers. It might also raise car prices and reduce the number of cars made in North America. This is what we've come to expect from a president who doesn't understand what his own administration is doing or doesn't care. And our controversy of the week, Trump's Hell Week. Is this a turning point? In Donald Trump's White House, the warning lights of growing legal jeopardy are flashing red, said Jonathan Swan in Axios.com. Last week, a jury convicted Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, of tax evasion and bank fraud. Only hours later, Michael Cohen, formerly Trump's personal lawyer, pleaded guilty to tax evasion and campaign finance violations, facilitating unreported hush money payments at the height of the 2016 campaign to women with whom Trump allegedly had affairs. Cohen declared that he committed these crimes in coordination and at the direction of candidate Trump. And Trump's Hell Week was just getting started. Federal prosecutors have reportedly given immunity to longtime Trump friend David Pecker, publisher of the National Enquirer, who kept a safe filled with unflattering stories about Trump and his family that he'd bought and buried. Alan Weisselberg, chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, who has true and deep visibility into Trump's financial and business dealings, also is reportedly cooperating with prosecutors. The cascade of bad news clearly rattled Trump, who raged about rats and flippers. His panic is warranted, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. We have reached an inflection point in the Trump presidency. Actually, there is almost certainly much less here than meets the eye, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Manafort was convicted for financial crimes unrelated to Trump. As for Pecker and Weisselberg, their immunity deals were part of the probe into Cohen's hush money payments. But it's unclear if they've agreed to talk to special counsel Robert Mueller or otherwise testify against Trump. More importantly, said Robert Knight in WashingtonTimes.com, none of this has anything to do with alleged Trump campaign collusion with the Russians, the supposed focus of the Mueller investigation. Do liberals giddy with fantasies of impeachment really think Trump's affairs and hush money payments, while undoubtedly sordid, will drive him from office? Let's take a look at what we know so far, said David French in NationalReview.com. The list of former Trump officials who are guilty of crimes now includes his former campaign chair, deputy campaign chair, national security advisor, and personal lawyer. We also know that other members of Trump's inner circle, including his son, Don Jr., and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, at least tried to collude with Russia in the 2016 election and then lied about it. Sorry, but the claims by Trump and his supporters that this is all a rigged witch hunt are ringing hollower by the day. No one can outrun the truth forever, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. When Mueller finishes his work, I predict the whole truth of Trump will shock the world, even more than it is already shocked. Trump's base will stick by him, said Selena Zito in the New York Post. The populist coalition he assembled knew who Trump was going in, and they've heard nothing to make them abandon and return elitist Washington insiders to power. Even if Democrats impeach Trump after November, Senate Republicans won't vote to convict because they know their party's rank and file stands squarely behind the president. We've known all along the rule of law and Trump would at some point be unable to coexist, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. Is it possible that Trump will, in the end, get away with everything, even if it's shown he conspired with the Russians? Given the tribal loyalty of Trump's voters, that question remains nerve-wrackingly open. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for carnivores. After the launch in upstate New York of the first raw meat vending machines, the Applestone Meat Company says its refrigerated machines will let consumers purchase sustainably raised pork, beef, lamb, and sausage at any hour of the day or night. It was a good week for rebuilding after the struggling Turkish soccer club Gulspor sold 18 of its youth team players to another team and used the proceeds to buy 10 goats. The profits from breeding the goats and selling goat milk, said team president Kenan Buyuk Fechterklub will be used to raise better young players. It was a good week for the lazy after a study into metabolic rates of mollusks during the Pliocene era concluded that the best evolutionary strategy for animals is to be lassitudinous and sluggish, with species that expend as little energy as possible having a greater likelihood of surviving. But it was a bad week for workaholics after a new study found that people who took less than 3 weeks of vacation a year were 37% more likely to die young, even if they exercised and ate healthfully. It was a bad week for swimming off Cape Cod after a Scarsdale, New York neurologist said he escaped a great white shark attack by punching the animal in the gills. There was no time to think, said William Lighton, 61, who suffered a severe bite to his left leg. And it was a bad week for throwing your wife under the bus after Representative Duncan Hunter, a Republican from California, blamed his spouse, Margaret, for their indictment on charges of using $250,000 in campaign funds for personal expenses such as tequila shots and an Italian vacation. She handled my finances, Hunter said. I didn't do it. And while we're here, an Only in America short piece. An Illinois woman was visited by police and investigated by child services for letting her 8-year-old daughter walk the dog around the block. Corey Wyden's ordeal began when a neighbor saw the child walking alone with the dog and called the police. Wyden, who was not charged, said she lives on a safe suburban block. No one will dictate my parenting choices, she said. Briefing page article this week is titled The Death of Local News. The watchdogs of America's local and state governments are disappearing. Can they be saved? What's the state of local news? It's a shell of its former self. The weekday circulation of U.S. newspapers has been in steady decline since 1998, when it was 62.7 million. Today, their print and digital circulation combined reaches only about 31 million, according to the Pew Research Center. Fewer readers means less subscription revenue, but it's the crash in advertising revenue that's been most painful. Newspapers' ad revenue plummeted from $48 billion in 2000 to $16.5 billion in 2017. Local newspapers that were once community institutions were forced to slash budgets and staff, and many folded entirely. Even in major cities, local news is struggling. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette just cut its print editions from 7 days a week to five, and the venerable New York Daily News laid off about half its staff in July, a move the tabloid's corporate parent, Trunk, said was made to reflect the realities of our business. Newsrooms employ almost 40% fewer people than they did in 1994, and newspaper reporter was rated the worst job in America for 4 years running, according to CareerCast, which ranks jobs based on factors such as stress, risks, compensation, and opportunity for growth. What caused local news decline? More than anything else, the internet. Older readers continue to buy newspapers, but younger readers who grew up expecting free online content and constantly updated news aren't inclined to pay for a printed product. As readers began defecting to online sources in the early 2000s, Craigslist made paid newspaper classified ads all but obsolete with its mostly free message boards. Classifieds once generated up to 40% of newspaper ad revenue, peaking at $19.6 billion in 2000. Revenue from consumer ads, meanwhile, has been gobbled up by the twin behemoths of Google and Facebook, which together accounted for 73% of all digital advertising in 2016, according to the Pivotal Research Group. Still another threat comes from niche new media startups that see opportunity in local newsrooms' vulnerability. Alex Mather, co-founder of the subscription-based sports website TheAthletic.com, told the New York Times his deep-pocketed company plans to poach the best local sports reporters in every city. We will weigh every local paper out and then let them continuously bleed until we are the last one standing, Mather said. Why didn't local papers adapt? In many small and mid-sized cities, multiple generations of the same wealthy family commonly own the local paper, often treating it as a public service rather than an exclusively for-profit venture. But as the internet began devouring their revenue, many waited too long to react, and the losses became unsustainable. Corporations and venture capitalists began to buy up local news outlets, often treating them as mere short-term investments. One such so-called vulture capitalist, Randall Smith, purchased several major regional papers, including the Denver Post, the San Jose Mercury News, and the Orange County Register, then slashed operations to the bone to maintain profitability. As Jack Schaefer wrote in Politico.com, Smith decided that more value can be extracted by sucking the marrow of the papers than by reinvesting in them. Do we still need local news? Only if things like schools, taxes, infrastructure, and government accountability matter to you. Where fewer reporters cover local business and government, Margaret Sullivan warned in The Washington Post, corruption can flourish, taxes can rise, public officials can indulge their worst impulses. When a local newspaper shutters, that same community experiences increased government waste and inefficiency. According to a 2018 report released by the Social Science Research Network, the loss of local reporting also depresses most citizens' engagement in local and state politics, leading to activists dominating the parties and greater political polarization. A 2015 Brookings Institution report found voters are less likely to cast ballots in congressional races than receive little coverage, producing more landslide contests and members of Congress who have less incentive to compromise on Capitol Hill. Conversely, robust coverage of local elections leads to greater voter turnout and more civic engagement. Can local news be saved? Only if creative innovations take hold. Some local newspapers have instituted paywalls requiring frequent readers to cough up money. Digital revenue, however, hasn't made up for the massive loss of print revenue. The nonprofit ProPublica is providing cash grants to help local newsrooms pursue ambitious investigative projects. And its local reporting network will expand in 2019 to support coverage of state governments. Veteran journalist Don Day spent the past year researching potential local news lifesavers and found inspiration from 19th century industrialist Andrew Carnegie, who gave away most of his fortune late in his life with a focus on funding public libraries. Day hopes Carnegie's example could serve as a model for wealthy philanthropists who would fund an $8 billion endowment to maintain local news operations in both large towns and smaller rural areas. It may be the only way, Day says, to keep a working democracy intact. And we'll move on to read a few of the best columns of the week. First comes from the U.S., Ross Douthat at the New York Times. Pope Francis' role in the cover-up. What did Pope Francis know, asked Ross Douthat. That's the big question now facing the Catholic Church after a new allegation that Francis was aware of and hid the sexual crimes of Cardinal Theodore McCarrick of Washington, D.C., in the latest bomb to go off in an already cratered Catholic landscape, Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, a former Vatican ambassador to the U.S., has publicly accused Francis of knowing that McCarrick had abused seminarians for years and yet released him from sanctions and relied on him for help in the ongoing struggle between conservative and liberal Catholics. Why would Francis do this? Francis needed allies, and McCarrick was sympathetic to the Pope's planned liberalizing push. Since the sexual abuse scandal came to light, both liberals and conservatives in the church, including conservatives Pope Benedict XVI and Pope John Paul II, have defended predators on their side for as long as revelations permitted. Now it's apostles of liberal Catholicism who've rallied to defend Francis, because he is their pope, and all's fair in the Catholic Civil War. But for the church and this pope to survive, Francis must lead a purge of all abusive or corrupt priests and bishops, no matter how many heads must roll. This is from Germany. Why we must buy gas from Russia. U.S. President Donald Trump may sputter and fume, says Hans-Peter Siebenhaar, but work on the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline is going ahead. At July's NATO summit in Brussels, Trump railed against the planned pipeline, which would transport Russian gas under the Baltic Sea to Germany and then to the rest of Europe, bypassing existing land routes over Ukraine and Poland, calling it a very bad thing that would make Germany dependent on Russia. Trump would prefer that we buy much more expensive U.S. gas, and his administration has threatened sanctions against companies working on the project. But Russian gas makes sense for Europe. Like its neighbors, Germany can no longer risk relying on the increasingly unstable Middle East to meet its energy needs. And if you don't trust Moscow, well, the project binds Russian companies not only to German energy firms, but also to British Dutch Shell, Austria's OMV, and France's Engie. Close trade relations are our key guarantee of peace and security. That's why at last week's Berlin meeting with President Vladimir Putin, German Chancellor Angela Merkel confirmed that the pipeline would aim to be operational in 2 years. Nord Stream 2 isn't meant as a slap at the U.S. It's a European necessity. This from South Korea. Lack of joint drills could kill. If war comes to the Korean Peninsula this year, the U.S. and South Korean militaries might not be able to work together, said Andrew McCormick and Lee Jong-ho. That's because for the first time in over four decades, the two countries have failed to carry out their large-scale August military exercise, Uchi Freedom Guardian, which typically involves more than 70,000 U.S. and South Korean troops, as well as ships and aircraft. President Trump surprised his own military in South Korea's after his June meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un by canceling major joint drills indefinitely, echoing Kim by calling them provocative. Defense experts say that decision could cause the deterioration of crucial relationships and expertise. The U.S. military rotates many troops into South Korea for short stints of just 1 year. So missing even a single drill could leave most of the force untrained in maneuvers with its key ally. Basic operations such as ensuring that aircraft fly at safe distances from one another require communications up, down, and across far-flung chains of command on both sides in both languages. What is the point of having U.S. forces stationed in the South, said retired South Korean Major General Kim Jong-ro, if we are not running the drills together. Last word feature this week is titled My Never-Ending Student Debt. 44 million borrowers in the U.S. owe a total of roughly $1.4 trillion in student loan debt, with no relief from lawmakers in sight. Journalist M.H. Miller is one of them. On Halloween in 2008, about 6 weeks after Lehman Brothers collapsed, my mother called me from Michigan to tell me that my father had lost his job in the sales department of Visteon, an auto parts supplier for Ford. 2 months later, my mother lost her own job working for the city of Troy, a suburb about half an hour from Detroit. From then on, our lives seemed to accelerate, the terrible events compounding fast enough to elude immediate understanding. By June, my parents, unable to find any work in the state where they'd spent their entire lives, moved to New York, where my sister and I were both in school. A month later, the mortgage on my childhood home went into default for lack of payment. In the summer of 2010, I completed school at New York University, where I received a BA and an MA in English literature, with more than $100,000 of debt, for which my father was a co-signer. By this time, my father was still unemployed, and my mother had been diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer. In January 2011, Chase Bank took full possession of the house in Michigan. Meanwhile, the payments for my debt, which had been borrowed from a variety of federal and private lenders, most prominently Citibank, totaled about $1,100 a month. My parents never lived extravagantly. College, which cost roughly $50,000 a year, was the only time that money did not seem to matter. "We'll find a way to pay for it," my parents said repeatedly. Like many well-meaning but misguided baby boomers, neither of my parents received an elite education, but they nevertheless believed that an expensive school was not a materialistic waste of money. It was the key to a better life than the one they had. Now 30 years old, I have been incapacitated by debt for a decade. The delicate balancing act my family and I perform in order to make a payment each month has become the organizing principle of our lives. I spent a great deal of time in the last decade shifting the blame for my debt. Whose fault was it? My devoted parents, for encouraging me to attend a school they couldn't afford? The banks, which should never have lent money to people who clearly couldn't pay it back to begin with, continuously exploiting the hope of families like mine, and quick to exploit us further once that hope disappeared? Or was it my fault for not having the foresight to realize it was a mistake to spend roughly $200,000 on a school where, in order to get my degree, I kept a journal about reading Virginia Woolf? The problem, I think, runs deeper than blame. The foundational myth of an entire generation of Americans was the false promise that education was priceless, that its value was above or beyond its cost. College was not a right or a privilege, but an inevitability on the way to a meaningful adulthood. What an irony that the decisions I made about college when I was 17 have derailed such a goal. After the dust settled on the collapse of the economy and on my family's lives, we found ourselves in an impossible situation. We owed more each month than we could collectively pay. And so we wrote letters to Citibank's mysterious P.O. Box address in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, begging for help. Letters that I doubt ever met a human being. The letters began to constitute a diary for my father in particular, a way to communicate a private anguish that he mostly bottled up, as if he were storing it up for later. In one letter he addressed Dear City, he pleaded for a longer-term plan with lower monthly payments. He described how my mother's mounting medical bills, as well as Chase Bank's collection on our foreclosed home, had forced the family into bankruptcy, which provided no protection in the case of private student loans. We were not asking in the end for relief or forgiveness, but merely to pay them an amount we could still barely afford. This is an appeal to Citi asking you to work with us on this loan, he wrote to no one at all. After 10 years of living with the fallout of my own decision about my education, I have come to think of my debt as like an alcoholic relative from whom I am estranged, but who shows up to ruin happy occasions. But when I first got out of school and the reality of how much money I owed finally struck me, the debt was more of a constant and explicit preoccupation, a matter of life and death. I would look at the number on my paycheck and obsessively subtract rent, the cost of a carton of eggs and a can of beans, my sustenance during the first lean year of this mess, and the price of a loan payment. At my lowest points, I began fantasizing about dying, not because I was suicidal, but because death would have meant relief from having to come up with an answer. My life, I felt, had been assigned a monetary value. I knew what I was worth, and I couldn't afford it, so all the better to cash out early. And so it felt good to think about dying, in the way that it felt good to take a long nap in order to not be conscious for a while. These thoughts culminated in November 2010 when I met with my father one afternoon at a diner in Brooklyn to retrieve more financial paperwork. My hope for some forgiving demise had resulted in my being viciously sick for about 10 days with what turned out to be strep throat. I refused to go to the doctor in the hope that my condition might worsen into a more serious infection that, even if it didn't kill me, might force someone to at last lavish me with pity. I coughed up a not insignificant portion of yellowish fluid before my father and I entered the restaurant. We sat at a table, and I frowned at the forms he handed me. I started the conversation by asking, theoretically, if I were to, say, kill myself, what would happen to this debt? I would have to pay it myself, my father said, in the same tone he would use a few minutes later to order eggs. He paused and then offered me a melancholy smile, which I sensed had caused him great strain. Listen, it's just debt, he said. No one is dying from this. My father had suffered in the previous 2 years. In a matter of months, he had lost everything he had worked most of his adult life to achieve. Throughout this misery, my father had reacted with what I suddenly realized was stoicism, but which I had long mistaken for indifference. This misunderstanding was due in part to my mother, whom my father mercifully hadn't lost, and who had suffered perhaps most of all. I felt a flood of sympathy for him. I was ashamed of my selfishness. The lump in my throat began to feel less infectious than lacrimal. Okay, I said to him, and that was that. When I got home, I scheduled an appointment with a doctor. It was in the summer of 2017, after my father, now nearing 70, had lost another job, when I finally removed him as a co-signer and refinanced my loan with one of the few companies that provides such a service, SoFi, S-O-F-I. SoFi has not made my situation much more tenable, necessarily. The main difference is that I now write one check instead of several, and I have an end date for when the debt, including the calculated interest, about $182,000, will be paid off. 2032, when I'll be 44. A number that feels only slightly less theoretical to me than 30 did when I was 17. What I have to pay each month is still, for the most part, more than I am able to afford, and it has kept me in a state of perpetual childishness. I rely on the help of people I love and live by each paycheck. I still harbor anxiety about the bad things that could befall me should the paycheck disappear. SoFi, which bills itself as a modern finance company, its name is shorthand for Social Finance Incorporated, is a Silicon Valley startup that offers, in addition to loans, membership outreach in the form of financial literacy workshops and free dinners. Their aim is to empower our members a mission that was called into question by the resignation in 2017 of its CEO, Mike Cagney, who employees allege had engaged in serial workplace sexual harassment and who ran the office, according to a New York Times headline, like a frat house. The news of Cagney came out not long after I had refinanced my loans with the company. I became, I suppose, a SoFier in the company's parlance. Around this time, I started receiving curious emails from them. You're invited to NYC singles events, or come celebrate pride with us. Dear NYC SoFier, one of the emails read, grab a single friend and join us for a fun night at Rareview Rooftop Bar and Lounge in Murray Hill. You'll mingle with some of our most interesting and available members. I am a 30-year-old married man with more than $100,000 of debt, who makes less each year than what he owes. Buying a pair of pants is a major financial decision for me. I do not think myself eligible in any sense of the word, nor do I find my debt to be amusing merely on a conversational level. Still, I felt as if in 10 years the debt hadn't changed, but the world had, or at least the world's view of it. This thing, this 21st century blight that had been the source of great ruin and sadness for my family, was now so normal, so basic, that it had been co-opted by the wellness industry of Silicon Valley. My debt was now approachable, a way to meet people. Let's say I was morbidly intrigued. The day after Valentine's Day, I went to a Mexican restaurant in the financial district for a SoFi community dinner. This was not a singles event, but simply a free meal. Despite the name tags, the dinner turned out to resemble something more like an AA meeting, an earnest session of group therapy. They all had their story about the problems caused by their student loans and how they were trying, one day at a time, to improve things. And no story was exceptional, including my own. Ian, an employee for Google, who had recently successfully paid off his debt from a Columbia MBA program, became something like my sponsor for the evening. He said he'd had a few bone-dry years when he'd lived on instant noodles. I told him I had a long way to go. At least you're doing something about it, he said sincerely. We sat down to dinner. Across from me was Myra, a defense attorney from Brooklyn who attended law school at Stanford University. Her payments amount to $2,300 a month, more than double my own. When I asked her why she'd come to this event, she glanced at me as if the answer should have been obvious. She went to law school at Stanford, and her payments are $2,300 a month. The table, myself included, looked on her with an odd reverence. She wore a business suit and had her hair pulled back, but I saw her as something like the sage and weathered biker of the group, holding her 20-year chip, taking in her wisdom about accepting the things you cannot change. After the food was served, a waiter came by with a stack of to-go boxes, which sat on the edge of the table untouched for a while as everyone cautiously eyed them. The group was reluctant at first, but then Ian said, the chicken was actually pretty good, as he scooped it into one of the boxes. Myra shrugged, took a fork, and added, this is a little tacky, but I'd hate to waste free food. And the rest of the table followed her lead. Maybe the next generation would do better, but I felt like we were broke and broken. No number of degrees or professional successes would put us back together again. For now, though, we knew where our next meal was coming from. This was excerpted from an essay that originally appeared in The Baffler. Here are a couple of pieces from the Health and Science page. Quote, definitive proof of ice on the moon. Scientists say they have found the first definitive evidence of water ice on the surface of the moon, a discovery that, if confirmed, significantly raises the chances of mankind one day building a lunar colony. The researchers based their claim on data gathered by NASA's Moon Mineralogy Mapper, M3, an infrared measuring instrument that flew on India's Chandrayaan-1 mission to the moon a decade ago. In a fresh analysis of that data, they found evidence of patchy ice deposits on the lunar poles of Earth's satellite. In the south, the ice appears to be concentrated in craters. In the north, it is more widely but sparsely spread out. Although lunar temperatures can reach a toasty 242 degrees Fahrenheit in direct sunlight, parts of the moon's poles are always in the dark. Scientists believe temperature in these areas stays below minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit, cold enough for water ice to remain stable for long periods in the airless environment. The ice could potentially be used for future lunar missions, either as drinking water or split into hydrogen and oxygen to create breathable air or rocket fuel. Lead author Shuai Li, a planetary scientist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, says previous finds of moon water were really just detections of hydrogen-enriched minerals. The very unique features displayed in the M3 data, he says, provide incontrovertible proof of water ice. Arctic's thickest ice breaking up. In another worrying sign of global warming, the strongest and thickest ice in the Arctic has begun to break up for the first time. The waters north of Greenland usually remain completely frozen over throughout the year. Scientists have labeled this the last ice area, on the assumption it would be the final place in the north to remain frozen. But abnormally warm temperatures this year have melted the ice down, making it thinner, and winds blowing across the Arctic are shifting it away from the coastline. In the past, most of the ice in the Arctic has been multi-year ice, Peter Wadhams, an ice scientist at Cambridge University, tells The Independent. Now nearly all the ice in the Arctic is first-year ice. Wadhams says the phenomenon could have serious consequences for wildlife. Polar bears use northern Greenland's cliffs to create dens for hibernation. When they emerge in the spring, they may find their usual hunting grounds have floated away in the ocean. And we'll go right on over to the Talking Points page. First article, Tibbet. Is immigration policy to blame? Go ahead and play your word game, said John Cass in the Chicago Tribune, and tell me about Molly Tibbetts. The 20-year-old Iowa college student went out for a run, never to come home. An illegal immigrant, Christian Bahena Rivera, has confessed to a murder. But liberals don't mind a few dead Americans if they can keep their political talking points, shamelessly decrying basic border enforcement as cruel and racist. Blame our unserious immigration policies for Tibbetts' death, said Mark Krikorian in NationalReview.com. The alleged killer reportedly used a stolen identity to work on the books at a dairy farm, paid taxes, and drove a car for years. That's a lot of interaction with government institutions, yet the alleged killer remained here with impunity. Tragedies like this are red meat to President Trump and his base, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. The White House tweeted out a video featuring families permanently separated from loved ones who had been killed by undocumented immigrants. It's a favorite tactic in the Trump playbook. Take an individual crime, then use it to argue that immigrants in general are a threat to the safety of every American. This strain of immigration hawkery helped put Trump in the White House, said Dara Lind in Vox.com, but it is immune to facts. Immigrants, including illegal immigrants, commit crimes at lower rates than native-born. And the number of Americans murdered by strangers is extremely small. But Trump wants you to believe you're either perfectly safe or you're not, and that nothing can possibly be done in the name of preserving order is too much, including building a 1,900-mile-long wall or deporting millions of innocent, hardworking people. When my friends and I read about Molly Tibbetts, said Monica Hess in WashingtonPost.com, we weren't thinking about undocumented immigrants or statistics or policy changes. We were thinking about all the times we have been approached by strange men, many of them white citizens, who reacted with verbal or physical assaults, you bitch, when we turned down their creepy overtures. It happens every day on buses and subways, on the street, even in workplaces. Every time, we wonder if we are going to wind up raped or dead. Can someone build a wall to protect us from men like that? Sessions, standing up to Trump. Let us now praise Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. President Trump's attorney general is politically backward in almost every single way, from his hostility to the Voting Rights Act to his fierce opposition to even legal immigration. But it turns out that deep down, Sessions has a redeeming characteristic, a quaint faith in the rule of law. President Trump has repeatedly attacked Sessions for refusing to quash the Russia investigation while demanding the Justice Department investigate the White House's political enemies. Sessions has quietly stood his ground, but after Trump once again publicly accused him of disloyalty last week, Sessions pushed back, saying, "The actions of the Department of Justice will not be improperly influenced by political considerations." For the Attorney General to defend the rule of law should not be an act of heroism, but in an age of Trump, that's what it is. Trump yearns to replace Sessions with a loyal flunky who'd end the Russia investigation, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But he's been constrained by warnings from Republicans that he couldn't get Senate approval for a suitably hackish replacement. Firing Sessions to quash Special Counselor Robert Mueller's probe, Republicans fear, would unleash a damaging constitutional crisis. But that calculation appears to be changing. Senators Lindsey Graham and Chuck Grassley last week both declared their support for Trump appointing a new attorney general after the midterms. The president, Graham said, is entitled to an attorney general he has faith in. Why shouldn't that be the case, said Adam Mill in TheFederalist.com. Under the Constitution, the voters exercise their control over the executive branch through the president. The Justice Department works for Trump, and if Trump believes that Sessions has mismanaged the ballooning Russia investigation, it's not only his right to say so, it's his duty. President Trump is absolutely entitled to an attorney general who will work for his policy priorities, said Cameron Smith in Birmingham, Alabama News. But that's not all Trump wants from Sessions. He wants Sessions to make his personal legal problems go away. That's what fixers do. Attorney generals don't. Or at least they shouldn't. Luckily for the country, Sessions isn't willing to be Trump's fixer. If he gets fired, we'd better demand that the same can be said of our next attorney general. And a couple of shorter notes. In the U.S., 6,721 Catholic priests were reported to the U.S. bishops for allegedly sexually abusing children between 1950 and 2016, according to bishopaccountability.org. That represents 5.8% of the 116,690 priests working during that time period, and it only counts those who were officially reported. Only 20% of American K through 12 students are enrolled in foreign language classes, compared with a median of 92% of students in European countries. Congressional Republicans are privately circulating a spreadsheet of more than 100 committee investigations Democrats could launch if they retake the House of Representatives next year. Among them, probes into President Trump's tax returns, his family business revenues from foreign governments, the White House staff's email practices, the response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and family separation at the border. The economic costs of climate change are already hitting the U.S. real estate market. The threat of flooding to coastal properties from rising sea levels has caused housing values in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and five southeastern states to drop by $14.1 billion since 2005, according to a report by First Street Foundation. On the poll watch, Senator John McCain was one of the most well-known and well-liked politicians of this era, with 58% of Americans holding a favorable opinion of him last year. In a 2017 survey of people Americans most admire, McCain took fifth place. We'll finish out with a quote from Albert Einstein, quoted in Vermont Public Radio, VPR.net. "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you.